Hear that? Believe it or not, summer is just around the corner. Luckily, Armor All, America's most trusted auto appearance brand, has what your car needs to get that perfect summer shine. Plus, now through May 31st, we'll give you $5 for every $20 you spend on Armor All products. That means car wash pods, protectant, tire shine, you name it. Find out how to get your $5 rebate at ArmorAll.com. Armor All. Less work, more clean. Terms apply.
The Athletic.
The race is on, and F1 is heading to Miami for the third time this week. But what should we expect from it this time round? And with F1 in America booming, and the Haas team going well in 2024, does the Andretti controversy threaten to undermine progress? I'm Ed Straw, and joining us to reveal all are Scott Mitchell-Malm and special guest, Günther Steiner.
Well, Günther, welcome to the podcast. Obviously, former F1 team principal, now a newcomer in the media world, so you're the... You're the inexperienced person who has to prove themselves in this particular realm.
Hello to everyone, and thanks for having me. Yeah, I wouldn't say a newcomer. You're pushing it a little bit out here, you know. I know a little bit about media, but on the other side normally, yeah.
Yeah, well, there's plenty of lessons to have learned there. But no, it's great to have you on. And Scott, are you looking forward to the chance to grill Günther?
Yeah, I feel bad because obviously normally, like whenever we've spoken to you before, Günther, it's obviously been primarily it's in the form of media sessions and press conferences, and it's all very structured. It feels weird that I don't want to say that we're in control here, but it's weird. It feels like the tables have turned slightly. You're just one of us now. You were on this pedestal before, but now you're just a regular media goober like us.
Just to clarify once, you never felt bad about anything, Scott, you know, so don't try to go there.
I just need to say the nice things now before we really get into the podcast.
Exactly. Just get them out of the way, you know. Yeah. Just get them out of the way before you start full attack.
And of course, you're an ambassador now for the Miami Grand Prix as well. So as well as that, you're doing TV stuff, all sorts of things. I imagine you've got plenty of other projects on the go that people don't know about as well. So how busy's life been for you since you left your role at Haas?
Too busy, I would say. I didn't expect this. It's weird, you know. It's just like the day after it was announced, I got text messages, could you do this, could you do that? And in the beginning, you know, not knowing now without joking, your world, the media world, for me, it was like, wow, I don't know what this is all about, you know, because I've never been part of it. So on that side, so there was a lot of things going on. And I said, guys, I'm not saying yes, but I'm not saying no, because I just need to find my way to this. So I'm more than busy enough, you know, and sometimes I think I because I wanted to have some time off, to be honest, you know, after all what happened the last 10 years, it was quite intense. The last 2 years, they were not likable, you know, as a lifestyle. So I just wanted, but then things came, and, you know, once you're in this industry, and you know that as much as I do, it becomes part of your life, and people ask you, yeah, you know the people, you don't want to say no, because in the end, you like what you're doing, you like the sport, you like the people, and then you say yes to this, and then the others, oh, but you said yes there, why you don't say yes to me, and off it goes, you know, so that's why I'm sitting here with you guys now. I did want to say no, but in the end, I know you guys, so, you know, I'm generous.
We appreciate that. I was wondering, because it must be quite nice after, like, I think you said several times, like, that being a team boss working in F1 wasn't, you know, the be all and end all for you. You wouldn't do it if you didn't want to do it and want to be there. So it wasn't like you were there, you know, you weren't a prisoner at Haas and there against your will. But now you're in a position to kind of pick and choose stuff. You can basically be as involved as in F1 kind of as you want now. That must be quite a nice bit of freedom versus what it was like before.
Absolutely. To make your own choices is always very nice in life, you know. And as you said, I mean, I wasn't a prisoner. I could have left before. And obviously, looking back now, I maybe should have, you know. But again, it gives me now the possibility to see the things from outside and understand why I got so frustrated as well. Because now it's easier to understand, because you don't have your daily job. Just keep on grinding away. Make sure that you do everything as best as you can. Just look at it and see why you actually got frustrated. And that's a nice position to be in. And by the way, I still go to some of the races. I think I do roughly half of them, see people and still hang around in the things I like to do in life.
Yeah, it's a lot to be said for a bit of perspective, isn't there? Sometimes just that step back and see things a little bit differently. But I guess people will be wondering, when will you be back in a Formula One team role? Is that something that you see in your future, or is that maybe one of those things that you're not directly seeking at the moment, but if the right thing came up, you'll go for it?
You said it all yourself, Ed. No, I expand a little bit on that one. It is one of these things. I'm not phoning up people to be a team principal, you know. In Formula One, there is ever a lot of things going on behind the scene, you know. And I wouldn't say that I'm involved in all of them, but in some of them, I know what's going on. And if some of these things come alive, I'm there. And maybe I'm a candidate for it, but I'm not like sitting here, getting up in the morning, trying on my agenda is phone up this and this people and lobby to be a team principal in that and that team. You know, no, I'm not doing that. I mean, I'm actually enjoying what I'm doing now as well, because I learn a lot again, you know, because for 10 years, I did more of the same every year. You know, the first years you learn, you do things, and then it's more of the same. And now it's a complete different perspective, and I learn a lot, and hopefully that helps me whatever I'm going to do in the future.
Alpine must be due another team principal change in the sort of next 6 months or so. So that could be an opening.
Yeah, I don't know about that one, but you know, I think they had quite a few in the last year, so I don't want to be the next one in and out, you know, because that's a fast revolving door, actually, you know.
Yeah, exactly. It's a good example of not getting back in just to take any job. There's I got the impression I know we bumped into joking about Alpine. We bumped into Otmar Szafnauer in Bahrain, and I know he's been at a couple of races the same as you have, Gunther. Just, you know, he's slightly less involved in kind of like media stuff than you are, but I've seen him lurking around his Otmar quite a bit, and I think he will be this year. And I got the impression chatting to him in Bahrain, I think it was, that just that when you don't have the chance to do a project that like your way, and you can just, you feel so frustrated because there's all these things that you had these grand ideas of what you could do, and you can see the impact that you can have on a team, but you never really get the freedom and the kind of role to do it. And I guess what you had at Haas, where, okay, I know it was Gene's team and Gene's name, but we said actually when you left, it was kind of Steiner F1 in all but name, because you were the one that built it. I think you'd probably be quite hard pressed to find another opportunity in F1 that gave you exactly as much responsibility as you had at Haas.
Yeah, no, but if you think about when Haas came along, nobody thought that will ever happen, you know. Not saying that you were wrong, because it never happened before. So what I always look for opportunities, or not what I look for, they always come up because I try to do things a little bit different. Obviously, very difficult to have another project like Haas, to be honest, you know, because unfortunately, I don't have that amount of money to do it my way, you know, otherwise it would happen. But it's you never know. That's why I say I'm not in a hurry. And I always say, if the project is interesting and challenging enough for me, I will gonna do it, but I don't have to do it. That's as well a nice thing, and I don't want to sound arrogant, but you know, if it comes along and I want to do it, I can do it, but I don't need to do it just to be there, not for my ego, and not also to have a job, you know, because life is good.
Well, you've got the challenge of doing a podcast with us, which hopefully will test you somewhat. So that's the
yeah. I don't think I can pay the soup with the money I make today from the podcast.
Consider it to be pro bono work. That's always
absolutely. You know,
it's really good for your profile, Gunther.
In which way? It could go both ways.
Yeah, suddenly Netflix won't be interested in you. Oh, hang around with them. Yeah, I don't want to. Don't want to do that.
When you don't get paid for work in the media, you're told to just accept that it's good exposure. So maybe that's what we should say to you.
I learned that one pretty quick, but it's good exposure. We haven't got any money, but it's good exposure. Oh yeah, I mean, you know, I tried to use that sentence when I went to the bakery to buy bread, but they still wanted money, you know.
So you should be more persuasive, but anyway, well, the good thing is we know we'll get more than what we paid for on this, which is always positive. But we want to talk about the Miami Grand Prix because you are an ambassador for that event, which obviously leans on your famous diplomatic skills, but also a great love for the event. It's a strange one, isn't it? It's a bizarre one to be at because it is so different. And I was wondering if you got a little bit envious that it was only the drivers that got the big hype introduction last year and the American treatment. The team principals as well are just as big stars almost now.
No, I'm pretty happy to have the drivers as the big stars, you know. I think, did we get it the first year? We got a little bit of introduction there as well. But that is not why you go there. I mean, for me, Miami is, as you say, it's a little bit of a special one because what I always say, what Miami brought to the sport is the expansion of race with entertainment. The idea of Tom and Tom Garfinkel and Stephen Ross to bring it to the next step, they actually achieved it. And if you see now, nobody's saying it, but a lot of the other races, they have a look at Miami. What did they do to all of a sudden being on the map with this Grand Prix? Because it was the last one in before Las Vegas last year, obviously. But what did they do different? That a lot of the Grand Prix, which have nothing else than racing, got a little bit of a wake-up call, but I would say also Miami, the idea, to have the idea, that's what I like in their vision of Tom and Mr. Ross, you know, to do something different, because when we were told in the beginning about Miami, it was like, yeah, I don't know if that works, it's maybe too American and all that stuff, but I think people really like it because it gives you a lot of things to do there the whole weekend, and then in the end, we are in Miami, and I do not know many people which don't like to come to Miami, you know, and especially if you put a good show on like they do normally there, the F1 people.
Do you think it's brought a lot to Formula One? Because there's much talk about the commercial value and also obviously the growing American audience. And it seems to be one of those things that has moved the needle. But what's the reality of when you're running a team, the benefit in terms of translating that into a few dollars that can then be spent on performance, which I guess is what it's all about?
Yeah, no, it's exposure. And exposure then, again, when other Grand Prix come for renegotiating, obviously FOM has got something in their hand saying, hey, look what they are doing. If you want to keep up with the neighbor, you need to do this, that, and the other. If the Grand Prix up their game, more people come to visit it and more people watch it on TV. And obviously you create the financial impact on it, which then benefits everybody. And mainly, I mean, it benefits FOM, but also mainly the teams because they get the biggest share of their revenue, you know. So people like Miami GP investing in this helps everyone, you know. And they invested quite a lot of money there, you know. So
one of the things I liked about the Miami Grand Prix in the second year was they'd learned a couple of really important lessons from the first one. And sometimes new races or race promoters that think they know best can kind of dig their heels in a little bit, and they're a bit reluctant to change. But from year one to year two, they did a massive change with the paddock layout, the team hospitality areas, moving it inside the football stadium. And I thought that was I really, really didn't know how that would work. And I thought that just selfishly from a working perspective, I thought it would be a disaster because I thought you're going to have people are either going to be in the pit lane or they're going to be at the back of their hospitality units in offices or whatever. You're never going to know where anyone is and you're never going to be able to speak to anybody, and it's going to be a weird arrangement. But it's actually really good. Like, it was, I think, I don't know what it was like for you, Gunther, but it seemed like everyone just went, oh, I can't be bothered to keep walking back and forth all the time. Most people were just in the hospitality and in that kind of like U-shape inside the stadium, and it actually created quite a unique paddock atmosphere. It kind of felt, I don't know, like the year before felt really claustrophobic, whereas in year two, it had a better, kind of more manageable buzz around it.
Scott, I'm impressed how well you observe these things, you know, how good you are at this stuff. Because, no, I think I start off with saying that that's what I always said to the Miami guys. The first year, it's always the most difficult one because, you know, you cannot get everything right. To pull off an F1 race, it's a big task, you know. But what they did, as you said, is like they listened to people and made things better. And I think they're doing from year two to three as well. Obviously, it will not be as big as it was from year one to year two. But what Tom and Tyler, the team there, is trying to do, always listen to people and make it better because they want the best event. You know, it's very... They really wanted personally to be the best event. So I think the same with bringing, when I went there last year, I was like, what happened here? From having, as you well explained, the little bit claustrophobic where I met with the hospitality the first year, to now the complete opposite, to this cool place, the coolest hospitality, and also the houses in there were very nice, you know, everything was there. So it was very cool. And this year, there is the grandstand tickets, which is called the campus ticket. You can actually go on top of the stadium and look into the stadium when the people walk in, you know, which I think is very cool. And not many other races give you that advantage, you know. So I think that is a very nice thing to do. So I'm with you there. I mean, they just try to make it better and better, and hopefully the best race in Formula One in the calendar year.
And I guess the main thing it needs is perhaps a classic race on track to really boost it, because it's brilliant off track. Obviously, races can't guarantee they're going to be great because it's dependent on so many things and the competitiveness of the various cars, etc. And maybe we can't be that optimistic about there being a massively close fight at the front. But I guess that's the thing that it really needs, which is ultimately something you can't necessarily create as a race organizer. It's just one of those things that happens almost by chance.
Correct. And some of the races say, oh, that was a great race, but that had nothing to do with it. It's just the circumstances which present themselves. And I think on the racetrack, they resurfaced the racetrack completely, you know, last year, because they had to, but they did all that one. And then, as you say, then we are a little bit into, you know, hopefully the race is getting interesting. Hopefully there's a big fight for the win, which we need a little bit more in the moment, as much as we try to hide away from that topic. But it would be nice that it's a fight for P1. But then again, we cannot take anything away from Max, because he's just doing a great job, and Red Bull is delivering as well. So, you know, but it will change at some stage. And hopefully Miami, we have got a good race.
The one thing I think I would like to see there, and it's not a short-term thing, so I didn't really expect it to change for years two or three, is over time it will become interesting to see what opportunities there may or may not be just to tweak the track slightly. Because you don't know until the Grand Prix actually happens for real what a layout will and won't produce, where there'll be opportunities, where there might be a little bit more, you know, restriction or whatever. And I know that the area that they've chosen obviously comes with a lot of benefits and creates a unique event. It unsurprisingly creates a few restrictions and limitations in terms of what you can do with the track with the geography that you have around it. But there will be opportunities there. And I know it didn't instantly wow people in terms of the on-track spectacle, but it's just a bit premature, I think, to write it off after two installments. I think get through this year, then you've actually got, you know, a slightly better sample set to work with, and there might be opportunities long term, because it doesn't feel like this is a race that's going anywhere. This should be around long term, and therefore with that comes more opportunities to actually explore how things can change. Because what you're never going to do, if the race is only going to be around for 4 or 5 years, you're not going to play around with the track layout every year, spend a load of money moving things around. It's just something that's going to have to play out over time. So I'm cautiously optimistic about it as an event on track and off track. It's just, it has unfortunately existed in an era of F1 where there has been a fairly predictable winner.
Correct. And I think on the track layout, obviously, as you said, with where it is, there are challenges, because you cannot do what you want to do. You know, in the end, you are restricted. But I think the right thing to do is, I think the first year there was a challenge with the surface. They repaved the whole track. And now I think we have to wait, as you said, a few races before there is really thinking going in, what do we need to change and what can we change? Because just making change for the sake of is not correct. It's not correct or incorrect. It's just like, I think sometimes you need to really understand what it's needed instead of just being reactive. You know, if you're not sure that you make it better, leave it like it is, make it stable, and then react from there once you've got a clear outcome of it. Because it's always like this. Whenever a new racetrack comes on the map, because it is not like, if it is not like any other one, we are all very quick to jump to the conclusion, oh, it is wrong because it isn't like this. But that's the human being, you know? And it's the same, like, if you're not doing like the other one, it must be wrong. No, it doesn't have to be wrong. It could be just different. It's neither better or worse. It's just different. And I think we need to give it a little bit of time that we, the drivers, get used to this racetrack. And then if there is somewhere really it needs to be changed, Tom will put effort in to make changes. But it's no point, because somebody shouts this is wrong, to overreact on a racetrack. Because you say changing a racetrack is very expensive and sometimes not really clear. While it was really clear with the paddock, you know, with the hospitalities, that there is I wouldn't say an easy fix. There is a fix, a very expensive fix, but let's do it because it will be better. It's clearly to be seen and it is better. The racetrack is different because we need to get used to it. And if you think about only 20 drivers race on it, you know, not more. So, you know, we need to be a little bit careful there. We've got only 20 opinions.
And the positive thing is that it does look like a race that's going to evolve over the years and not be a flash in the pan, which is very positive. We'll get back to the pod in a moment, but first, a word about our partner, Grammarly. No matter what kind of work you do, how you communicate is key. All those emails, reports, and presentations are equally important to the collaboration needed to get things done. And Grammarly can help. Grammarly is your AI writing partner to help you communicate more effectively and efficiently so you can make a bigger impact at work. I know from experience that Grammarly can help you save time on any writing task and ensure you feel confident about what you've produced. In fact, 96% of Grammarly's users report that Grammarly helps them craft more impactful writing, and their tone suggestions can help you navigate even the most difficult work conversations. Make a bigger impact at work with Grammarly. Sign up and download for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. Easier said, done. We've got to talk about the Haas team, obviously, because we've got you here, Gunther. It's your life for a decade or so before your departure. There would be no Haas team without you and those who maybe weren't following when it was created. You know, the whole idea of the alignment with Ferrari and the technical partnership was pretty much your idea. But given everything that happened there, are you surprised by the strong start that the team's had this year with 5 points, I think, so far?
No, not really. Last year, when I was still there, obviously the car was designed last year with Simone Resta, with Simone is not there anymore as well, you know. I think the performance of the Haas car is not surprising to me because we knew end of the year what the performance is, but I'm a little bit surprised of how other cars underperform. I think like the Alpine, I think everybody's surprised the works team performing like it is performing. I mean, the Williams, I expect it better. So in the end, how the Haas car is doing, because I see it, the gap to the big teams, you know, that gap, I think we could envisage it couldn't be any smaller because just of the resources you've got at Haas, you cannot do much better, you know, and the team there in Italy last year when they knew where we were and when we decided to change track to go to another philosophy of the car, you know, to another concept, obviously that was the aim to get there. So I'm not really surprised about that. As I said, I'm surprised a bit about the opposition, that they are not really there. But I think the stake have one team. I think they showed that they are better than they were in the first races. Obviously, they've got some challenges with the pit stops, you know, because 20 seconds is a little too long. You know, you cannot make that one up on the track. I think even Red Bull would be struggling with that one. But I think they will come back about the same pace as the Visa Cash App and the Haas. So I think we will get into a little bit of fighting there in the second half of the season.
You've done an excellent job there to give everybody their official team names. That's very diligent.
I always try to do my best, Scott, you know, because I'm in the media world now and we'll get critiqued immediately.
Were you always furious when we only referred to the team as Haas rather than MoneyGram Haas?
I wouldn't say furious. I mean, you know, I take them, my picks, who is good and who not.
With the, it's
interesting. We always like Rich Energy Haas. That was our favourite.
you never will forget that one. I will never forget that one.
It's interesting that you mentioned like other teams underperforming relative to what Haas has done at the start of the year, because in the team's best starts to the season in the past, it was such a different era of F1 in terms of the competitiveness of certain teams that were massively underperforming. You know, most of the early years of Haas came at a time when McLaren, for example, were just unrecognisable from where they are now. Force India or Racing Point or whatever it was called in a given season was going through various stages of struggling to exist. So that would often, they'd normally get good through the year, but they'd often start the year with like an old car or behind the schedule or whatever. Williams was obviously just in complete dire straits. There was so much low-hanging fruit, and that if Haas could overachieve by just doing the best job possible while others struggled. But what do you think is the team's kind of natural place in the pecking order now? Because one of the things we were worried about over the winter, obviously when you'd left and we knew the sort of background to that, was sort of, okay, what's this team's ultimate potential? We were kind of worried that actually if all 10 teams hit their 100%, then Haas is 10th because it's the smallest team. It has the arguably the most limited structure and setup now. Get why it had to happen in 2016, obviously, but it's a different kind of F1 now. But where do you see it? Because it's hard, obviously, to gauge everybody's theoretical maximum.
Exactly, as you say, the theoretically we can, but if you just take the facts, the resources people have available, and you guys know who has got what, I mean, like we all do, because we have to start off, all 10 teams now are solid. You know, as you said, the backmarkers are gone. There is no backmarker anymore. It's more like who has got the best resources, who has got the deepest technical knowledge of things, and the deepest pockets. As much as you say, we've got the budget cap now, and everybody is almost at the budget cap. Yeah, you could be 5 million under, 10 million under. Does it make a difference? Yes, but that's mainly with the upgrades you cannot bring to the track. But it's more like, how much financial have you invested in the future of the team? You know, that is now the question. And how much you can get out of it, of your investment? How good of a job are you doing? It's not because everybody can now produce a good F1 car beginning of the season. Obviously, you have the like we have this year, some people are a little bit off, but they're not 2 or 3 seconds off. They're 2 or 3 tenths off. All of a sudden, you're last if you're 2 or 3 tenths off. So we are, everything is at a very high level because it's so close together. But where it comes in now is how you plan for your future with the team. You know, what have you got to get the best out of your operational budget cap money? You know, how much have you invested to get the best out of it? And I think it will take some time that it ebbs out, but then we will see. And always you have to do a good job. As soon as you're not doing 100% job anymore, you're at the back, you're 10th, you know? So somebody like Haas, which has obviously a smaller infrastructure, can still beat 1 or 2 teams. But can Haas get onto the podium with his own means? Maybe not.
That's interesting because the way it's played out so far this year, obviously, like, Williams has had, when you listen to James Vowles and Pat Fry, Williams has had one of the worst winters that they've ever experienced in their long histories in Formula One, but they've still got a car that's comfortably quick enough to get into Q2 most weekends. Like, that's what a bad off season yields now in F1, whereas a few years ago a bad off season would have been, well, like Williams was in 2019, where you miss the start of testing and then your car's crap and it's also illegal and it's just an absolute disaster. With what Haas has been able to do, and you mentioned Simone was the technical director up until the off season as well, so what we have seen at the start of this year, or the launch spec car certainly, was obviously when he was technical director. They've obviously, with the core components that existed last year, that didn't change. So the people and the team that struggled last year in terms of that final product produced something that has done much better this year. So there wasn't like a, it's not like there's been an enormous overhaul, total clear out of personnel, whatever, and this is the car that those new people have produced. So in hindsight, was there anything you think actually you wish you'd intervened on sooner last year or handled differently at the start of last year? In hindsight, could 2023 have played out any differently for the team?
No, not really. 2023, when we realized, I think we realized maybe 2 months too late where we were with the concept of the car, that we didn't make any progress. But I think between Simone and myself, we made the decision, we look into next year, which was 24, and let's focus on a new concept, because we knew with the old one we couldn't do it. And we didn't have the money to build a complete new car, because you needed to change the chassis. As you see, there is the side impact structures. They're completely different. That couldn't be done last year. So I think nothing could have been done different. But it's not only that, you always know what you can achieve. And that is the difficult bit to explain. I mean, being there, you can always try to become 7th, 8th, 9th, if everything goes fantastic, 6th. But at some stage in my career, anyway, that gets frustrating. You're fighting always for the same. You're not trying to better yourself, you know. It's not like, and that's what I try to speak with Gene, say, we need to invest in the company if we want to go on the podium, if you're serious about it. That is what I would like to do. And, you know, for me, keeping on beating myself up to be 6th, 7th, 8th, or 9th, it was getting up. There's other things to do in life as well, you know, because I'm not getting any younger. And in the end, if Gene decides to do that, he is entitled to. I'm not taking that entitlement away because he owns the team. But then obviously he didn't like my attitude anymore because I wasn't happy with that. You know, maybe he's happy to be now being seventh. That's great. Yeah, I've been there. You know, I've done that. You know, and you know, in the end, you need to be ambitious if you go racing. You know, you cannot say, okay, because you guys see with how it is now, what is the chance that the Haas gets on the podium in the next 3 years?
Go on, Ed, you can answer.
Oh, it's, well, on merit, it's zero, isn't it, pretty much?
Exactly.
And I mean, there may be a freak set of circumstances, but yeah, on performance, yeah, it's not going
to
happen.
You know, I've got a freak, you know, I don't even have got that one to win in the lottery because I don't play the lottery. But anyway, you know, it is like this. And this is, and that is now when I sit back and I see it now from outside, I said, it's the same, like I say, I give the biggest example with the pit stop. I think the guys at Haas are good. They can do a 2.9 pit stop, but can they do a 2.1 pit stop? No. It is not the guys. It's the whole. It's not the one person. It's the whole, you know, the equipment, the software, the amount of people, the amount of training, all that stuff. There's not one thing. There needs to be something changed fundamentally, you know?
This comes back to what you say a lot, Ed, which is that people. I think it's very easy for people to underestimate the difference between a very good and a great F1 team. You know, the you know, how often do we say it when we're talking about other teams on the grid where it's like a car that seems like a disaster because it's only fifth or sixth fastest is still a bloody good racing car.
There's no still bad teams really in F1, good. Yeah.
Exactly. And it's the same, and it would be the same for the personnel, for the facilities and stuff like that. I reckon we could go to any team on the grid probably and be impressed by what we see, but you'd still be able to see the difference between a good team and a great team. And then that difference is, but just manifests itself in what? Half a second on track over a single lap?
Yeah. And that's the difficulty. This is difficult to explain to people because, oh, how can you not make up this? It's so deep, you know, you need to really think how, and I say the great teams, what they've got in place is just like out of this world. So some of the facilities, like the simulators, I mean, you know, they are big tools now, and if you don't have them, to try to find 2 tenths on a Friday night for qualifying without a simulator, you will not, because you cannot blame the people doing the setup of the car. They cannot test it, while the other one go and have got somebody in the factory driving in the night to find out what is best for the next day.
One thing that was interesting about when you moved on from Haas, there was a lot of stuff from Gene about having more engineering led, I think having engineering at the heart of the team. Do you feel there was any degree to which you were sort of stretched in multiple directions in the role you were doing? Because from what I've seen, the role IO has as team principal is a slightly narrower role than maybe the one you had. Obviously, you're from an engineering background, but you're not kind of a coalface F1 engineer as IO was being. So I'm interested whether you think there's been any sort of shift in that, and whether when you look back, whether there were areas that you basically had to make a choice of what areas you focused your time and energy on in order to grow the team longer term, rather than making the absolute best and getting that last 0.5% right now.
I think, as you say, my role was a lot broader because I had to find the money to keep the team going, you know. So, yeah. I mean, you can be engineering-led, but if you have no money to do anything because he wouldn't pay for it, you know, it's like you need to do that other one as well. And I mean, in 2020, I said it numerous times. I mean, there was no chance that we are on the grid in 21 if I wouldn't have gone out and found the money, you know. So in the end, yeah, it's a different role, and I don't know exactly, and I have no opinion about it, and I don't really care in a good way. I don't care, you know, I'm not careless, but how they're doing it now, if he puts money in or who's finding the money, I don't think they find a lot of money because I haven't seen a lot of sponsors on the car, new ones. So, if he decided now he's paying for it, it's fine. But he always told me, I don't give you any money, you need to find your own money. So obviously my job was different than Ayao's.
Yeah, and I think it's fair to say that if you hadn't been doing that, the team probably wouldn't have made it through the COVID period. So,
Correct,
absolutely the right balance there. I do think, given F1's back in the USA and your role as a former boss of an American team, it's interesting to ask you your position on Andretti, because obviously when we asked you, and you were asked 1,000 times over the past couple of years,
2,000,
about whether the
2,000,
I wasn't counting all of them, but we I'm sure perpetrated a few of those, but I was wondering whether your perspectives changed in any way on that, because there is a difference between you now as an external observer and previously someone who was responsible for preserving the value, if you like, of one of the 10 teams. Do you still have roughly the same position, or has it shifted a tiny bit?
No, I still have roughly the same position, because what we just discussed before was like we've got 10 strong teams. As soon as you dilute that, maybe you end up with only 8 strong teams and 3 weak ones. So, and obviously I have no vote. I had no vote before. I've got even less now, you know, and I don't want to speak for Stefan at FOM, and FOM is monitoring this very well. They need to create a healthy environment for the teams which are in there now, which put a lot of investment in. And I think if they will decide when the time has come that really they can accept an 11 team. I mean, what Liberty Media did with F1 since they voted 5 years ago, roughly, it's great. You know, they created value for the teams. Why would they dilute it now if they don't think it's time, the time is not ripe, that they can keep the same evaluation like it is now by adding people? So it's more for them to do. So in my opinion on that one is like, Until everything is solid and everybody makes money, it's better to wait for an 11 team or 12 team, whatever it is, and see what is happening with F1. Maybe one team goes really bad and they say, oh, we'll let another one in. You know, that could be an opportunity again. And I think Andretti is doing the right thing. They are ready. If the opportunity arises, obviously it comes at a cost. They are ready to go for it. But otherwise, I think F1 is in a very good position to evaluate where the business stands of F1 in the moment for the teams as well.
In the of the many things that have changed in F1 and the wider landscape since you obviously went through the new team process to get Haas on the grid, one of the things that is very different this time is that back then it was universally agreed that F1 needed another team. So that wasn't controversial that process got opened up. Everybody was on the same page. Obviously, you were in charge of one of the existing teams when this process was opened up just over 12 months ago by the FIA, and I don't know, it might have been different on the inside, but for us as observers from the media side, that just looked like a completely unilateral decision by the FIA and the president. Were you surprised when that happened? Because that, to me, has really undermined and compromised this process from the start, is that this process began, teams like Andretti were encouraged to go down this path, even though it never looked likely from the outside that it would be successful, because it felt like it was only the FIA that actually wanted a new team on the grid.
Yeah, I was surprised that they got the go-ahead from the FIA. And I don't know the details why, and they were never explained to me anyway, maybe not to anybody, why the FIA maybe thought it is a good thing to have 11 teams, for sure. For them, it's a good thing. They get more entry fees and stuff like this, you know. So it isn't a bad thing, but I think it was a little bit surprising also, as you say, that they didn't talk between FOM and FIA to make that before making the decision from the unilateral decision from the FIA.
That's your favourite subject, Ed.
The yeah, lack exactly.
of communication between them.
Well, yeah. That's a big weakness in Formula One, I have to say. But it's very difficult with Andretti because there's clearly money there. It's General Motors, the biggest car company never to have been in Formula One. It's a big name, obviously, Andretti, popular in America. So it's a big deal to say no to that, because this isn't just a sort of an optimistic team that's not got decent infrastructure there. They're looking quite convincing. So that's the thing that worries me about it, that it's maybe the sort of team that can add value to Formula One. That's the thing that's always troubled me about this, the definition of adding the value. I take everything you say about the stability of the 10 teams. I think that is a fair argument. But the adding value, etc., that argument can almost be used in perpetuity, I fear, in terms of whether it dilute the existing teams. That's where I have my concern with it.
I need to correct you there, Ed. As much as you know about Formula One,
the FOM
has not said no to General Motors and Andretti. They have said, let's come back in 28 when General Motors is coming. So they left the door open. They didn't shut. I mean, we always have to respect that as well, because General Motors has to show. I mean, FOM was very clear in 28, you know, when you bring the engine, you can have a team. So I think I need to, I don't need to defend FOM. I just want to clarify that little bit, which was said when they said, no, we don't give you a license for 25, 26, but in 28, I think when you show what you've got, you're welcome. I think you show us what you've got and if you're happy with it. So I don't think they've closed the door completely. So we have to respect that as well. You know, and if General Motors is serious, they work toward that. And I think they're doing it with the investment they make, and maybe they come in 28. So I think, obviously, FOM is in a strong point in the moment. F1 is doing good. So it's our rules or no rules, you know?
No, I think you're right on that. But though I must admit, I still find the 28 thing a little bit vague from them. But you are technically correct on that, so I will give you that.
It's all about technicality, set in Formula One.
It is the best kind of correct. The one thing I would like to see from FOM, I think, off the back of the statement that they put out, which did lay out, as you were saying, Gunther, that point about 2028 and when GM's in and it's a proper works team, is they've been very specific on certain things. And I think we would all benefit from just a tiny bit more clarity on a couple of other points, because one of the really weird distinctions, actually, between when FOM put that statement out and then Andretti followed it up soon after, was a big part of the FOM argument was, we don't think that they can enter for 25 and then build a car for 26 as well. And then Andretti came out and said, oh, but we've never been planning on entering in 25. It's all for 26. And I just thought, well, one, that's not been your public messaging at all. You've been saying 2025 for ages. And two, if that's not your plan, why does FOM think it's your plan? And it's just, I think to me, that was just symptomatic of this whole thing, where I genuinely don't think that Andretti and FOM have had proper communication over this and proper conversations. A lot of the Andretti stuff has been done being very public, being very aggressive. It was Miami a couple of years ago, wasn't it, where Michael was going around with the petition. And then FOM have kept some stuff private, some stuff they haven't divulged that maybe they could. So maybe a little bit more clearer communication from both sides would actually help. It wouldn't necessarily change the situation fundamentally, but it might let us all have a slightly clearer idea of actually what's going on and what they're planning and what it is that FOM doesn't like about it.
I agree with that one, you, Scott. When I read that one, exactly that same thing. And then two weeks before, they showed the car in the wind tunnel, which was obviously a 25 car, you know. So I was a little bit confused, but in the end, I don't really look into that deep. But as you say, what we all can see that the communication, I mean, it was even said that we didn't get the email and all that stuff, you know. It's like, okay, there was no communication. So I think normally when I started the team, the first thing I did, I bothered everybody so long until they couldn't see. They didn't want to have any communication with me anymore. Not the opposite, you know. They couldn't stand me anymore. And that is what you do. When you want something from somebody, you communicate and explain what you want to do and try to do your best. It's almost a sales job, what you have to do with FIA and FOM. And I don't know how much they did of it, but I just read what you guys read. For me, there wasn't a lot, because I said we asked for a meeting, but it went into the spam. You know, it's like, okay, could be true. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I'm not saying they're lying, but that's not a good way to start.
It's a really sensitive spam folder if that's considered not important. Like, what exactly. What emails are getting through if that doesn't make the cut?
Correct. So it's a little bit strange. But anyway, you know, that we will find out in a few years what really happened behind, you know. So, but we are all a little bit, chuckling a little bit about the whole scenario, that it wasn't as clear as it could be and as should be.
Well, I definitely say that the way that you and Haas went about it, more than 10 years ago now, certainly is a good template for Andretti to have taken. Just finally, sprint race in Miami. Excited about that? Do you think that's going to add a little bit more to the race and the American appeal?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I quite like the sprint race. I would say if you would have them every weekend, that would be a little bit too much, because especially now with me in the States and the racing all over the world, I have to get up too many nights to watch the races, you know. But otherwise, I think it's always a good thing to have. There's a lot going on in Miami, you know. F1 Academy, that's good as well. You know, the women racing series racing there as well, which is very important for the future of F1. And the sprint race, obviously, you know, there is a competition. There is something on Friday to get excited about on qualifying for the sprint race.
Brilliant. Well, thank you very much for your time, Gunther. We know you've got more ambassadorial work to do. So thanks for joining us. A great podcast debut with us. So your media career is going strong.
Thank you very much, Ed. And thanks for having me. Thank you, Scott, as well.
Well, Scott, as we said goodbye to Gunther now, it's worth just getting your thoughts on Miami. How much are you looking forward to it? You've been at the previous two Miami Grand Prix, so you've seen the way it's growing. Where is it in your races you're excited about going to? Because we all have our own little rankings. It's amazing, even amongst the journalists, we all have different races we like and are okay about or dislike. So where does it stand for you?
Well, now the ambassador's dropped off the call to go and get on with the rest of his day, I can be honest and say my real opinions about about Miami. No, like I was saying earlier, I know it's not a blockbuster race on track, and I remember you and I having these conversations around the first event and writing about it, in fact, that it was never going to live up to the hype, was it? Because it was just so oversold in the build-up about being this, you know, defining new sporting event, not just on track, but everything else around it. And then obviously Vegas succeeded that as the most bombastic race in Formula One. But actually, if you broke the Miami Grand Prix down to what it is, like, it's fine. Like, it's not one of the best ones, and it's not one of the better ones. I don't think, like, it's not in my bottom three. I think there's a lot about it that is very good. But as I mentioned when we were talking to Gunther about it, it's the track is my biggest concern still, because it was always going to be limited. And I really, now that Gunther was at, I know he was obviously following up my point, so I don't want to say like Gunther was absolutely spot on about this, because it makes it sound like I was saying I was right. But Gunther pointed out that there were other things in years one and two to focus on. You know, the track surface needed redoing. And then, honestly, I know it's really hard for people to perhaps understand this who weren't there on site, but and you didn't get to experience the new layout last year, but you got to experience it in year one, Ed. And I cannot tell you how big a difference. It's really hard for me to articulate how much better that was in year two. And I know to the people outside, that's not a big deal. But one, that was an enormous, enormous project, focus, cost, etc. And two, it had a massive impact on the flow of the event. It was so much better for the teams, the drivers, obviously for us as well. So I'm coming at it from a selfish perspective. But I get why those were priorities.
You could kind of feel that from the outside. I think the thing that's encouraging, gently encouraging at this stage about Miami is there's a danger, and it still might be the case that the race is a bit of a flash in the pan in that it's there for a few years, lots of people go, and then it drops off. I'm encouraged at the fact they are trying to evolve it, and that there is the chance for it to create its history. And every race has to start somewhere. And as we talked about in the post-Chinese Grand Prix podcast, that race disappearing and then coming back was a good chance to evaluate actually what it did offer to Formula One and what the circuit does. Now, Miami's still got a way to go, and you're absolutely right about the circuit, but I'm a bit more convinced there's a chance now for this to continue to evolve and really establish itself properly, because I was a bit concerned it might get frozen out, because you've got COTA, the Circuit of the Americas in Austin, as the real racers race, the fans race. You've got Las Vegas as the razzmatazz, the entertainment capital race. And I did wonder if Miami might get a little bit squeezed. Okay, it's over the east side of the country, so it's got its own catchment area, but that's the one thing I wondered. I don't think that's played out yet, but it's got a chance.
Yeah, no, I would agree, and I shared your concerns about, you know, does it get sort of lost in a little bit of US Grand Prix limbo between Austin as the racers' race and Vegas as the glamour race, because it did eclipse Miami very quickly, Vegas, and I think I said on the podcast we did around Vegas last year that what Las Vegas has is what Miami tries to tell us it has in terms of this destination race and blah, blah, blah. But there is a big benefit to it being in Miami, because yes, the track is removed and isolated in the stadium, but as an event and something that people want to go to for the week, and the celebrities that you can get there, the fans, the American fans that want to go and because you, to a greater or lesser extent, you do need it also to be in a place that people want to go and spend time in. You know, like if you're going to go there for the race, you're probably going to be there for a few days around it. So that has to be factored in as well. And so Miami does have a lot of stuff going for it. That, well, one thing that I am optimistic about, I haven't seen, you know, a tremendous amount of evidence to support this yet, because I think it is something that plays out over multiple years. I do wonder if Miami will slowly go down the Austin route a little bit more, because it's interesting that you, and I agree, because I did it as well, and I would automatically refer to it as this. It's interesting that we think of Austin as the like authentic racers race, isn't it? Mm. Because that's massively showy. And in the first years, it really stood out like a sore thumb on the F1 calendar, in that what they lent into, the stereotypes, the cultures and stuff like this. It plays up, doesn't it, to something in the region. It's not inauthentic, but it's also not, you know, it's not just a race that lets the racing speak for itself, is it? They've got loads of other stuff, including the concert.
Yeah, maybe to slightly crystallize my thoughts on that. I think Miami's kind of the more the VIP showy element of it, and the sort of the American showiness, whereas Austin feels a little bit more like an event that just, if there isn't such a thing, because it's such a broad country, but it sort of everyday American race fan will go to and enjoy, and there's lots of peripheral stuff, and it's still got the kind of American event feel.
Racing's at the heart of it.
Yeah, and it's more focused on what I would call the everyday fan, which of course is the lifeblood of any sport. So yeah, that's kind of the difference I see.
No, absolutely. But what I mean is I wonder if what Miami's play will be longer term will be, okay, Vegas is hoovering up, you know, the extremities on the hospitality, celebrity, entertainment side of things. Miami can still lean into that to a great degree because every Grand Prix is trying to do that now. So it's not just you have to pick between one or the other. Miami can still lean into that quite heavily. But if it was able to find a way, for example, exploring ways to improve the track longer term, and maybe putting on a slightly better schedule of support races as another example, if it found a way to just lean into the racing side a bit more, I think it would take itself further away from Vegas, and then it wouldn't risk looking like a poor imitation of Vegas in terms of what it offers the F1 calendar or the place it holds on the F1 calendar. To a degree, there would be a little bit of a risk that it does fall into that limbo where it's not quite Austin, not quite Vegas. Maybe, and I'm not suggesting that that's the solution to it, but I think it is something that Miami can do, because Vegas, for what is good about Vegas, and I actually think we did have a very good race, and there were elements of the track that absolutely played into that, that there's more to work with in Miami and the surroundings, the fact that it's contained, blah blah blah, from a racing perspective. So they can do more, I think, to make that a better race than Vegas. It won't be a better event because Vegas is Vegas, and it will always benefit from the fact that F1 and other companies want to be involved in that in a way that no other event, I suspect, can get involvement in. But Miami can still achieve a lot. So the second year boosted my enthusiasm for this event. I am looking forward to going back. I'm curious to see what elements are better, and if anything's got worse. And yeah, just refresh my memory a little bit, and it'll be interesting when we come to record the post-race podcast. You're more than welcome, Ed, to remember this conversation and fire that first question at me and just say, was it actually as you remembered it? Had it been hyped up a little bit in your own brain? Has it got better? Has it got worse? And where do you stand on the Miami Grand Prix now? I'd be more than willing to have that in my mind as I go through the weekend next week.
Well, thanks, Scott, and thanks again to Günther Steiner. It was great to have him on the podcast. Hopefully we'll get him again in the future. Head to therace.com. Don't forget the hyphen. Loads to read there. Check out our other podcasts, including Bring Back V10s, that tells classic F1 stories, and the Race F1 Tech Show with Gary Anderson. Have a look at our videos on YouTube as well. We're going to be heading off to Miami imminently, so stay with us for everything you need to know from the world of Formula 1.
The Athletic.